Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One House, Three Generations, our series on how and why neighborhoods change. It's called York and Figg, continues today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 2nd of December. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. So listen, here is what we do on this program, what we try to do. Anyway, we take business and the economy and we make them make sense in our lives. And there is not much that is more central to our lives than where we live and what happens in the economy around us in that place. So we're doing a project this week. Our wealth and poverty team has been reporting it actually for 4.5 months now about what happens when that economy that we live in changes. We opened up a news bureau in a neighborhood about 8 or 10 miles from downtown L.A. called Highland Park. Gentrifying is the word that best describes it. Money has come in, people, too, who were willing to spend money, which means other people have moved out, and not always because they wanted to. Housing costs have gone up a lot. But if you have lived in that neighborhood called Highland Park for a while, if you're an old-timer, it's an opportunity to sell high because the newcomers can and will pay top dollar. So, to get us going today, Marketplace's Noel King looks at one house on York Boulevard and three generations of its owners.
Hi, Elsa. Nice to see you again.
How are you? Good to see you.
Oh, you too.
Every once in a while, Irma Alvarado drops into the Century 21 office in Highland Park to visit Elsa Kim, the realtor who helped sell her house 3 months ago.
Here.
Oh, I kind of miss Highland Park, so I had some errands to run.
Well, thanks for stopping by.
Irma lived at 4784 York Boulevard, a tan bungalow with a pitched roof, a little porch, and a big backyard for 36 years. When her husband got cancer, they decided to sell so she wouldn't have to worry about keeping up the house after he was gone. About the same time, a real estate investor approached Elsa Kim.
He had heard that Highland Park was up and coming, and he wanted property specifically on York Boulevard. So we send letters to all the homeowners soliciting their property. And then Irma got one of our letters.
And she got in touch. The investor passed on her house, so Irma and her husband put it on the market.
Basically, we had looked around as far as what the property values were that were in the area. And we had come up, my husband and I come up with a number of $500,000 for our property. But once Elsa and Jeff went and saw the home, they said, oh, absolutely not. This can sell for lots more.
Elsa says she and her partner, Jeff Hutchins, knew that with the market in Highland Park as hot as it is, $500,000 was too low. For a smallish house, the Alvarados bought for about $78,000. They bought it to escape gang violence in neighboring Glassell Park, but a few years later, the gangs followed them in. Irma remembers hearing gunshots one night.
My two girls, they threw themselves on the floor and they were doing a walk like this, a crawl walk. And I was like, what the heck's going on here? And my husband says, I told them that they hear gunfire, they have to throw themselves on the floor and start crawling to the back room. And I was like, oh my God, this is too much.
That was 20 years ago. Now, after selling with her husband gone, Irma rents an apartment in a community for people 55 and older. She still visits the area to take her dogs to the vet and get her nails done. Irma really likes Highland Park's transition, the young families and new businesses. Recently, she was talking to a friend about the neighborhood.
She says, the other day she was, I saw this man walking his dog in short little shorts and sandals, and he had a long beard, and he was just as cool as ever, like he was a hippie or something. I say, well, I go, that's a trend now in Highland Park. A lot of younger, white, very crafty people are kind of moving into this direction.
Welcome to the construction site.
How's it all going?
It's going, a little bit at a time.
Katie Dormeyer and Benoit Guérin bought the house on York, and they're renovating. Along the way, they're seeing traces of former owners.
Here's where we've been working today. We have spent a lot of time on these walls. There was wallpaper, and then they painted over the wallpaper, and then they painted over the paint, and then they wallpapered over the painted-on wallpaper, and then they painted over it.
They're doing a lot of work themselves. Benoit is handy. He's a technical director for educational theater. But they paid $520,000 for the two-bedroom, two-bath house. So wouldn't it have been easier to buy one of Highland Park's professionally flipped houses with their perfectly painted or wallpapered walls?
A lot of the places that were flipped that we did visit, they were done inexpensively or so magnificently that we couldn't afford them. And a lot of these houses, we felt like they were soulless.
Not so with their house.
Irma left us some sage and a pack of matches on the fireplace, and I was so touched to find that.
Katie and Benoit have seen gentrification before, she while living in Chicago and he in Montreal. They know there's a downside to it, that some people are displaced and that there can be resentment. But they hope that by buying a home rather than renting, they can mitigate some of that.
I think there's a greater sense of social responsibility being a homeowner as opposed to being a renter. I'm interested to know that face.
I'm just agreeing with you. I've never had a rent where I was like, oh, and I'm going to be here for 25 years.
The couple still have a lot of fixing up to do. The walls are a patchwork of old plaster. They've scraped off the popcorn ceilings. So in the meantime, they're living in this small basement unit. It's packed with racks of clothes and a big bed, and Benoit says they were told that somewhere down here, there's a sump pump, too.
That year rained a lot here in L.A. The house had a basement. That year, the basement flooded.
That year was 1977, and that is Iris Pareles. Her mother, Olga Lawrence, was a Cuban immigrant who worked as a nurse's assistant. In 77, the house on York was hers. Fed up with the flooding, she sold it to Irma Alvarado's family after owning it for only about a year. She bought another house a few miles from Highland Park and left it to her daughters when she passed away 6 years ago. They were astonished when they saw the York bungalow sold for more than $500,000.
I cannot get it in my mind. How would anyone? I said, I'm gonna see when it goes on open house because I wanted to see what they had done for 520-something thousand. I can't.
But despite Iris's disbelief, the same kinds of changes are coming to this neighborhood. Gentrification spreads. At some point, young couples like Katie and Benoit, who chose Highland Park because they were priced out of other L.A. neighborhoods, will be priced out of Highland Park. So they'll look for some place that hasn't been discovered yet. Iris and her sister Nancy can see it happening. Real estate agents have started approaching them.
I've had a lot of requests to sell. Down the street here, I've seen a few of the houses being sold and new people moving in, young white families. I think Highland Park, all of that is spilling over to Elysian Park. So I think it's coming up here too.
Iris says the realtors tell her their house, which cost their mother $63,000, is a hot property. They say the sisters could probably sell for close to $500,000. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Our series about Highland Park and how it's gentrifying is called York and Fig, which is also, as it happens, the address of our bureau there, the corner of York Boulevard and Figueroa Street. Everything from the series is online, videos, audios, and stills, the whole smash. It's YorkandFig.com. It's entirely possible you wouldn't do this if you weren't a business journalist. But that said, were you nonetheless to have pulled up a chart of the ruble today, as I did, you would see a curve for the Russian currency that heads pretty steadily south starting this past summer. In fact, yesterday, the ruble had its biggest one-day drop against the dollar since the late 1990s. So what is a country to do as its currency collapses? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at Moscow's options.
Let's look at the perfect storm that's causing the ruble's woes. Top of the list are falling oil prices and economic sanctions from the U.S. and EU due to Russia's involvement with Ukraine. The latter is keeping investors away, says Alexander Clement with the Eurasia Group. And then there's this big one.
The Russian government is letting it lose its value, is letting the ruble depreciate.
The country had been spending billions buying rubles with the hope of stabilizing its currency, but it stopped a few weeks ago, in part because it didn't want to deplete its foreign reserves, basically the country's piggy bank. When sailors find themselves in a big storm, one strategy is to drop the sails, batten down the hatches, and wait it out. This is kind of what Russia's doing right now. Nicholas Spiro is with Spiro Sovereign Strategy.
Russia, unfortunately, has to basically ride this storm out and hope that the damage is not severe enough, that it will essentially bring down the whole financial sector.
Spiro says if things get worse, Russia could try buying up the ruble on a massive scale and raising interest rates. That'd be very expensive and very risky. It could also try limiting how much money people take out of Russia. But
that would send a terrible, terrible message to the markets.
Russia has another equally unlikely option, says Will Pomerantz, a Russian specialist at the Woodrow Wilson Center, a think tank.
Try to resolve the situation in Ukraine. There would be a chance that the EU and maybe even the United States would reduce its sanctions or even lift its sanctions.
Russia could also try to convince oil-producing countries to decrease production, raising prices. But that's also unlikely. So, yeah, ship at sea, trying to wait out the storm. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On the heels of the big hack at Sony Pictures Entertainment last week, in which salaries, performance reviews, and Social Security numbers, not to mention some big-ticket unreleased films, were released, the FBI is warning companies in this country to beware of some serious cyber trouble. Kim Zetter is a senior staff reporter at Wired. Kim, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
I'll tell you what, this sounds ominous. The FBI coming out with, quote, a 5-page confidential flash warning yesterday. Should we all be worried?
Yeah, so these don't happen very often. And this one is a warning about a wiper attack. We hear a lot about stealing passwords, stealing bank cards. A wiper attack is malware that's designed to actually destroy data on a computer. So it's a little more worrisome.
The proximate cause of this thing was the Sony attack of a week ago. Sony, as we know, has been truly whacked by this thing. Lots and lots of problems. How much, spitball it for me, not just Sony, but how much is it going to cost the company should they get wiped like this? I mean, a lot of time and effort, right?
Yeah, a lot of time and effort. Obviously, you know, we're hoping that a company like Sony has everything backed up, and certainly they should. So if you've got stable backups that are current, that are done nightly, and they're extensive, then it's just restoring those backups, and those can take several days. If they don't have certain material backed up, then, of course, they're screwed.
Do you buy, by the way, this whole idea that North Korea decided to go after Sony because of that movie?
No.
You know?
But, you know, who wants to be the one that says no and then it turns out to be?
I think you just did.
Here's the thing. Nation-state attacks aren't generally really noisy like this, and they don't generally start with a picture of a skull on computers. That's kind of the hallmark of, you know, hackers like Anonymous and people like that. And also, there are some interviews, I don't know how much we can trust them, by people who claim to be from the hacker group Guardians of Peace that are say that they're responsible for this. Mm-hmm. And they're criticizing Sony for their bad security. And that's not usually a nation-state move.
Are there individuals at risk here, or is it a businesses-only thing based on the FBI warning from yesterday?
No, a lot of the material that's been leaked so far, if it's trustworthy, it hasn't been confirmed by Sony, it's a lot of personal information about employees. It's including, you know, 3,000, 4,000 Social Security numbers. There have been some reports, possible passports of media stars or Hollywood stars, and salary leaks. You know, what employee wants their salary leaked out to the world like that?
All right. So other than backing it up smartly, what does one do if one runs a big conglomerate? I mean, hopefully you get your IT staff in a room and say, hey, man, come on.
Well, it's a little late for that. Everyone is going to get hacked. Everyone is going to get hacked. And so the question is, what is your game plan for dealing with a hack once you discover it? And obviously, backing up is important. But there are other things that you need to do, and that is to have a good response team so that you can respond quickly. You also want good hygiene among employees to know what they should and shouldn't do. You know, if you know that hackers are in your system, you want to prevent them from exfiltrating data. So you can't necessarily prevent hackers from getting in, but there are things that you can be doing to monitoring and logging to make sure that important data isn't getting taken out. And in that case, it looks like that didn't happen at Sony.
Kim Zetter at Wired, her latest book, which we had her on with, what, like 3 weeks ago, Kim? Something like that?
Yes.
Is called Countdown to Zero Day. It's about the Stuxnet virus. Kim, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
this is about my life, so why don't we make it as authentic as possible? Why not shoot here? No one shoots here.
Mark Maron makes a star of Highland Park as our series York and Fig continues. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped 102 points today. The century mark plus 2, 0.5%, closed at 17,879. No, I don't know where that came from. The NASDAQ gained 28.6%, finished at 4755. The S&P 500 added 13.6%, finished at 2,066. Boy, does Sprint have a deal for you. Switch from AT&T or Verizon, and Sprint will charge you half of what you were paying forever. Investors, of course, hated that whole idea. Sprint down 3%, AT&T down 2%, Verizon down nearly 2% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose to 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Representatives from the 566 federally recognized tribes are expected in the Capitol for the White House Tribal Nations Conference hosted by President Obama. The Federal Reserve issues its latest Beigebook summary of commentary on current economic conditions, the last one for the calendar year. And let your creativity and generosity flow. Tomorrow is Make a Gift Day. Oh, how thoughtful. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. November auto sales came out this morning. They're among the key barometers of economic health that get picked over each and every month. Sales of cars and light trucks in this country are as strong now as they have been in a decade, and not just because of the improving economy either. Tim Fitzsimmons explains what is bringing people back into the showroom.
Carl Brower from Kelley Blue Book says there's millions of cars worth of pent-up demand because of the Great Recession. Combine that with what he says is the best lineup ever from the big three American automakers.
Meaning they aren't just strong in the large truck and SUV categories, which they've been strong in for decades. They actually have very compelling cars, small cars, mid-sized SUVs.
Things were also helped by old-fashioned bargains and promotions. Kurt Fry operates the Sunnyside Automotive Group near Cleveland, and he had a gift card deal going over Black Friday weekend.
We offered them from 9 a.m. through 11 a.m. on a website, and at 9:05, all five of the $500 gift cards were already spoken for. We sold five cars in about 15 minutes.
Compare that to an average day of three cars sold. Plus, gas prices have been falling, and pretty much all cars are more fuel efficient. So how does that play out for Fry's customers?
Probably not that much of an economic factor. But for someone that's looking at a $12,000 to $15,000 used car, and they can buy an $18,000 new car, and that new car gets 30-plus miles per gallon, now that math really matters.
George Magliano from IHS Automotive says all this adds up to a buyer's market.
The market is up for grabs amongst anybody, okay? And so you really have to have the product, and you got to fight for your market share.
So consumers who have been waiting for the right time to buy are finding that time is now. I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Podcast fans among you will recognize this next interview. No, sadly, it's not Sarah Koenig in Serial. Comedian Marc Maron lives in Highland Park, which is, as you know, the subject of our gentrification project this week. He produces his popular podcast. It's called WTF, out of his garage. He also shoots his autobiographical television show in the neighborhood. It airs on IFC, and it's called Maron. So we did the logical thing and swung by his studio not too long ago.
We are in the garage behind my house where I do my podcast from and where I store all of the artifacts from my entire life, pretty much.
It is a little shrine, I got to tell you.
It's all in here. It's a slightly organized, small warehouse of me.
One of the things that's interesting about your podcast specifically are the things you get people to say in front of a microphone. And that's clearly intentional, right? Because this is a really intimate space, close quarters, and they're in your home.
I don't know if it was intentional. Where else was I going to do it? And I always sort of had a dream of doing, of working in my garage one way or the other. I'd set it up originally to make it a workspace, but it never really came to pass until I set up these mics. So the intention was to have a space to work in. So the fact that it is cozy and it is all my stuff and it is kind of quiet out here. And also, I do long-form interviews. So when you're sitting in here and we're just talking one-on-one, like I don't really know that this guy's got a mic sticking in my face. I don't think about it that much. And I think most people, after about 20 minutes, they don't think about it either.
Give me your Highland Park origin story.
I was driving this guy, Tim, around, who was looking to rent a house in Garvanza. I had never been out in this neighborhood. I was living over off Franklin. Had a little money saved from a deal I had with Fox Studio that didn't go anywhere. And I don't know, I was driving this dude around and he was looking for a house. I saw this little house with a for sale sign in front of it, this little maroon mission style house. And I went in And I was like, this seems cool. I'd never bought a house before. And I was with a woman. I said, I think I found this house, but I don't really know how to buy it. She's like, I'll show you how to buy a house. So we came up here and we bought this house.
You talk about Highland Park a lot in your podcast. You talk about it a lot on the show. I mean, it's set, for crying out loud. Your show on IFC is set in Highland Park. Why?
It's a short walk to work. I mean, you know what I mean? It was like the way we were shooting that show. I was like, this is about my life, so why don't we make it as authentic as possible? Why not shoot here? No one shoots here. I like that it still feels kind of like, you know, rough. Like, I like that, you know, the streets are kind of screwed up. You know, the houses are kind of bizarre. There doesn't seem to be, you know, it hasn't leveled off, and I really don't want it to level off. It seems like a lot of, you know, third or fourth generation Latino families live here. You know, I don't want them to go. You know, I like that, you know, that a lot of different kind of people live here, and the hipsters still look out of place. I don't mind being out of place that much.
You're a 50-year-old man. You think you're a hipster?
I don't know. You know, I just, you know, I dress a certain way because after a certain age, it's hard to figure out what your head will look good on top of. So, you know, I don't know if I'm a hipster. I wear plaid Western shirts and jeans. I don't know what defines that. It seems like it's a pretty shallow idea.
Do you worry that a guy like you, like think about yourself 10, 12 years ago, right? If you came into this neighborhood today, you wouldn't be able to afford this house.
I guess that's true. I don't really check the real estate listings, you know, and I know a lot of guys are flipping things. There was a period where I was looking to move into a bigger place when I was with this woman. But when when we broke up, the idea left too. I get very dug in. I get very committed to things. But yeah, I guess the real estate's going up, and I guess there are people flipping homes and making them bigger and stuff. But yeah, I don't know how to account for that. And I hear a lot of people are paying in cash, which means, you know, either mommies and daddies or show business money that comes and goes.
Because you talk about it so much and because your television show is based here, do you worry that you are, not to overstate your influence, but are part of the reason that people come here?
I don't know. You know, I've thought about that myself. I don't know what kind of influence I really have. I mean, it seems like realtors and, whoever those trendsetters are, have been trying to do this for years. That they've been trying to make this neighborhood hip for years. I think it was on the radar of, real estate speculators and real estate agents as something that could happen.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you, man.
Down the hill from Mark Maron's house, maybe, I don't know, a mile or so, right on York Boulevard, which is the main drag in Highland Park, is a liquor store called Liquor Azteca. It's been there for more than a decade, so its owners have seen the way that neighborhood is changing their business.
My name is Armando Santos, and I'm a partner here at Liquor Azteca de Oro, and I do a little bit of everything here with my brother Robert.
My name is Robert Santos. I'm the owner of Liquor Azteca de Oro. It's a gold mine.
It'll be $14.79.
The hipsters, the new people in town, they've been coming and asking for new products, like different ones, unique ones, like, for example, moonshine, a whiskey called rye whiskey that I've never heard about. So we're just getting them whatever they wish.
Some things I don't even know what I'm carrying. This is vermouth, right? Vermouth? I don't even know what vermouth is, to be honest with you. Do you know what vermouth is?
Do you want to see the beer selection? Before, we just had Budweiser, Miller, Coors Light, but now we have like imported beers. Those are your craft beers. This one's from a brewery that's located in downtown LA.
You could say the gentrification, is that what it is? Economically, it's working for us. We've been here 14 years, and I do remember our first days, I sold approximately $50. So that wouldn't even cover the light bill. Hola, ¿cómo estamos? Pásale.
Gracias.
I have a bunch of regulars, but they're getting fewer and fewer and fewer. It does make me sad in a way, but I don't have time to be sad. That next person's going to buy some American Spirits and leave me $7 instead of $5. That's the way business is, I guess.
Gentrification is a broad term. We know that it is not the same thing everywhere. So do us a favor and take a minute and tell us, or show us, really, what gentrification looks like where you live. Take a picture, tag it Gentrification Is, and put it up on Instagram. We'll see it, we'll grab it, and we'll put it on our website as well. Our whole series about Highland Park and how it's changing is at yorkandfig.com.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, it's a number in the form of a quiz, and it's a long one, so hang in there with me, would you? Here you go. 18,505,529,328,561.45. It is, as you may or may not have guessed, the national debt of the United States of America. I mention it because, A, yesterday we went over the $18 trillion mark for the first time, and B, I thought it was interesting. Also, C, partisan and or political inferences will not be entertained. Thank you very much. All right, we're done. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you again tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.